My name is Jaben Moniz Nakamura. I am the Integrated Resources Manager at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. I manage the archaeology and cave program for Hawaii Volcanoes, and I have my PhD in archaeology. Really, my, work is really focused on the 1790 event in terms of the archaeology and the culture with that.
Yeah. So, can you at all paint the picture for me of the time?
Okay, sure. So, so Kilauea is an explosive volcano. And between 1500 and 1790, it was in a very explosive period. And so Hawaiians would have experienced that when they were coming through the area or living really anywhere on the island, as we can see now. And in 1790, it was a particularly explosive event that occurred. And it was recorded by Hawaiians because of what happened there, especially what happened to Kiowa and his army as they were passing through.
Where were they, and what was it like for them?
So Kiowa and his army, Kiowa was from Kau, and he had been battling with Kamehameha for quite a while. And it was, you know, they were really very bloody battles. And the two armies had separated, and Kiowa was on his way back home to Kau. And he was taking a traditional route that went through Ola'a and up through the caldera area and eventually hooked up into Kau. And he stopped with his army overnight at the crater's edge, and they stayed there overnight. And there was a lot of earthquakes happening, and they thought, well, maybe they had, you know, upset or disturbed Pele because, you know, she was obviously upset over something that was going on. And so the next morning when they got up, Kiowa made a, you know, pretty good decision, and he decided to split his army into three groups, and he sent them off separately. And as they were traversing away from the caldera through the Tau Desert, a huge explosive eruption occurred, and the second group of his warriors got caught in that explosive event, and it probably was a mixture of hot volcanic gas and steam and sand and ash that came down and engulfed the warriors. The third group coming up behind came upon them and found them. They had all perished. And the story goes from there, really, when the geologist discovered the footprints back in the 1920s, they tied the footprints and what happened there to the story of Kiowa and his army. And the reason we know about Kiowa is because it was such a huge event in Hawaiian history. When in 1823, when the Reverend William Ellis came through Kilauea, he was the first European to travel through there. He was actually told about the event by his Hawaiian guide. And then in 1857, a 19-year-old tax collector named Frederick Lyman was going through the islands, and he was, you know, doing one of, you know, what all governments do. They collect taxes, and they need to know people's names and ages. And Hawaiians didn't, they didn't record their ages by dates. They recorded, you know, by significant events. And one of the events that he wrote down in 1790 was called Kionihelele, and it means the falling sands. And so we know that that is also tied to that eruptive event. And so the event itself was named Kionihelele.
Wow, this is so fascinating. I'm desperately trying to picture all of this as you're describing it. The area where Kiowa's army was, what is that terrain like, and what do you think it was like for them when the eruption happened?
Well, it was probably a lot like what it is right now. If you were to walk out there, and the area is closed for, you know, good reason, because it is, you know, it has very high gases and ash. But it was a Kau desert, so it was a very open area. They were likely walking on the Pohoihoi flows that are still there today, walking across on their known trail. And they likely got caught in that ash event. And, you know, the ground was probably covered in this muddy ash. But again, the footprints that are out there were identified as being from Kiowa's army, but we've since done quite a bit of research in the early 2000s, and we now believe that those footprints were probably not just from Kiowa's army, but from other Hawaiians who were traveling through there on their everyday work and ventures, because the prints, they don't just go one way. They don't go just away from the caldera. They go both north and south, so to the caldera as well as away from it, and as well as east and west. And we also discovered over 240 other archaeological features related to the explosive event or the trail that we now think was being used pretty commonly by Hawaiians traveling through there. So there are temporary shelter sites as well as areas where they were getting volcanic glass and lithics, which is the blocks that are thrown up during these eruptive events. They're very fine basalt material that come raining down. Hawaiians discovered this material was excellent for making adz, and we found hundreds of these sites where they were actually sitting there and actually making these adz over a 1,000-acre area along the caldera's edge.
Awesome. And so, but once the ash started falling, Jade, why would they be going toward the crater?
Well, probably because they knew this adz material was there. Hawaiians were just incredible for being able to live in this very volcanic, very active place. And, they understood their landscape, and they understood what was happening. And so, this was a major trail system, and they knew that this material was coming out of the volcano, and it was an excellent material to use and to make their tools. It was one of five quarry sites on the island, so, very highly prized.
Oh, so this ash could have been falling, and they were just going on with their business.
Likely between explosive events, they were going through there. I mean, the footprints are really, it would have taken about a week to dry because it went up so high into the atmosphere. It would have taken about a week for that to dry, and so they were walking through it and leaving their footprint impressions. And there's also two ash-bearing layers. So there's two, distinct eruptive events that occurred, and there's footprints that have been identified in both of those layers.
I mean, and no matter what, we're talking about people walking barefoot on Pahoehoe.
Right. Yes, that's correct.
Wow. So there's no sign, though, of I'm just also interested in what else you might have found out about how people continue their lives even during eruptions like this.
Well, I think this entire island, and not just these types of eruptive events, but all kinds of eruptive events that have happened, and people have gone on and continued to live their lives. I mean, the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park is home to thousands of archaeological features. And really, they are a testament to, the Hawaiian people's ability to move on and to continue on and to use their environment and to make their homes in these places. That is on top of an active volcano.
I mean, people weren't really like waiting for the palm, for the coconut trees and the grass to grow, right? Or what? Would they?
It's hard to say when people would come back in to kind of recolonize areas that had been covered by, say, a lava flow. But we know from this eruptive events, because we have their footprint impressions literally, fossilized in the ground, that they were back there pretty soon after a big explosive event.
Huh. And so the sort of historical importance of it was what?
Well, you know, it's one of those stories that we can tie to a specific time. And, you know, this event, you know, we have the geological evidence, we have the archaeological evidence, we have the ethnographic evidence really coming together and forming this, you know, this story. And I think we can learn a lot about it, you know, in terms of understanding what's happening with the volcano today, you know, on top of, you know, what happened in 1924. You know, it really just gives us a really deep picture into time about these, you know, nature and what's happening there back in 1790 and what's happening there today.
It really does. I mean, was the 1790 kind of the most, you know, commented on volcanic eruption in Kilauea's history?
Well, 1790 sticks out because I think a lot of it is because of the story of Kilauea, because it was such a huge explosive event, you know, much bigger than what we're experiencing today, and from what I understand from geologists, much bigger than what happened in 1924. You know, the plume was so high, you could see it all the way over in Kauai High. John Young, who was, you know, stationed at Kauai High, actually wrote about it in his journal, that he could see the plume. So that's how high it was and how high it went up into the atmosphere. And, you know, of course, you know, the death of a portion of Kilauea's army, you know, makes it, you know, that much more significant as well.
And its effect on the, I guess, leadership of the island?
Sure. I mean, you know, after that event, and, you know, it may or may not be directly related, you know, Kilauea went on to meet Kamehameha and really, you know, his, you know, came to his death. And it could have been, you know, it's been hypothesized that it was as a result of, you know, this negative event that happened to him. But, you know, we don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Were there other, you know, notable eruptions prior to 24, between 1790 and 24?
No, not that I'm familiar with.
I see. That's interesting, huh? So for the whole 1800s and the beginning of 1900s?
Right. You know, so then Kilauea went into what, you know, what we are more typically familiar with, which was, you know, the lava flows and the ponds, you know, the perch ponds and that sort of thing in the caldera, which was, you know, one of the things that really attracted visitors to what is now Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, because it was, you know, you could go and see an active lava flow, and it brought visitors from all over the world to view.
And from 1790, then the next big, you know, ash explosion kind of event was 1924.
That's right.
Which is being compared, you know, pretty closely with what we have now, right?
Right, and that's because, you know, it was, again, the closest in time. You already had the Volcano Observatory was already there. It was established in what is now the park in 1912. So you had geologists there able to study it, you know, people were documenting it. You have photographs from the area. So there's, you know, quite a bit of information from that 1924 event that we can kind of draw on for today.
Uh-huh. And again, the reaction of the people in general.
People were living on the, you know, it's living on the lava landscape is, you know, kind of what I call it. And, you know, there's an area in the park called Kealakomo, and it has agricultural remnants where they were growing sweet potato. And if you go out there today and you look at this area and you wonder how in the world were people surviving here, well, one of the reasons why they decided to live and plant there was because there was an ash deposit that had been deposited from, you know, sometime between 1500 and 1790 from that, during that explosive phase. And that ash deposit, they were able to grow plants to eat off of. So, you know, they were really looking across the landscape to where they could best thrive and survive.
What? So it's kind of a flat lava landscape around this area that where there's enough ash to grow things?
Yeah, there's enough ash there that they were growing. They were growing likely sweet potatoes and other products.
What's the name of that again? I'm going to have to look for it on a map. Not that I can find a map that's got it on it, but...
It's called Keala Como, and in the area we were working in is called Keala Como Waina, so it's kind of the middle section. And Keala Como is the Ahopoa.
Oh, I see. So it is kind of more by the Hili Napali area?
Yeah, below that.
Oh, below that. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So that is all that same coastline, and so it's evidence of how people dealt with the aftermath of that formation of the coastline, just as it's being
right.
formed again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, after an explosive eruption, you know, it deposits the ash, and, you know, this is a good place to go and grow your crops.
Did you mention when those would have been, those settlements, maybe?
So Keala Como, we've got some dates from some limited excavations that we did there, and that it was, you know, pretty late 1700s, early 1800s.
That is really fascinating. And why do you think they would be abandoned? How many people might have lived there?
We don't know. We haven't done populations, you know, statistics. We haven't done any of that kind of research. But, you know, over time, when westernization came, you know, westerners came into the islands, and it really forced people, especially in these more rural areas, you know, they have to pay taxes now, and they were being pulled away to other areas, other jobs that they had to now make money in. And so a lot of these areas eventually, you know, were left because Hawaiians were forced into a more Western society.
Wow. That the way you put that turned on a little light for me. Really, Jade, you know, and how lifestyles are forced to change, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Have a great weekend. Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.